Morning, members. I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resource Policy and Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum. I'd like to approve the minutes of February 10th. Representative Penton, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye. Opposed, aye. Nay. Amendments are adopted. Welcome, Commissioner. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
I will do so. My name is John Lankstein. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. For those of you who I've not had a chance to meet with, I just wanted to give you a little of my personal background and then begin our agency budget overview. I'll have a few slides sort of on a high level of our agency strategies and goals, and then about our organization, and then I'll hand it off to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka and our Chief Financial Officer, Lyle Mueller, to finish the presentation. My background is I grew up in Minnesota. I went to the University of Minnesota. My degree was from the College of Agriculture back in the days before the university's what they now call CFANS, College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences. I was with a degree in soil and water resource management, so I was kind of trained to become a SCS or SWCD office person or technician to go out and design and install, help design and install water control and erosion and sediment control devices. I started working for the DNR while I was in college, and I worked for the DNR for 25 years as a hydrologist and became an administrator in a couple of different areas at DNR. Then I went to the Department of Health for 6 years, and I worked in environmental health issues, dealing with drinking water, public and private wells, all the regulatory aspects of risk assessment, and had a very interesting time at the Department of Health dealing with Representative McNamara on some issues in his that affected his district with groundwater contamination. And then 4 years ago, I came to the Pollution Control Agency as a deputy commissioner, and the governor then appointed me to commissioner in 2012. So I have been a public servant my entire career, and appreciate the opportunity to represent our agency, an organization of about 900 employees, many of whom are like me, career public servants who were trained in science or engineering and who work to protect and improve the environment and enhance human health. That's our mission. And there it is. This is a nice picture of the resources we all care about that we use and endeavor to protect and improve in our state. This is a photograph of the Root River, folks kayaking on the Root River down in southeastern Minnesota. And we have, as you know, many and varied water resources across the state. I wanted to give you just a quick snapshot of our five vision statements that we use in our strategic plan, where we describe what we want the future to look like in Minnesota. And because we listen to our stakeholders and built these strategies with their input, we work for cleaner air. And that can support healthy communities and a strong economy. Minnesota is fortunate to sit on the edge of the prairie landscape. In our state, we have good meteorology most of the time for clean air, but we have some days and some parts of our year where we have inversions and other conditions that create unhealthy air conditions, especially in the metropolitan area. Our land that would support healthy ecosystems and sustainable land uses, we implement a number of programs to clean up contaminated sites. Those sites that you might have heard as Superfund or some of our old petroleum tank sites, the land and water that was degraded in the past in the early 60s, two tank spills is what really led to the formation of the Pollution Control Agency. One was a soybean oil tank spill near Mankato. The other was an oil tank spill and leak into the Minnesota River in Shakopee. And those tank spills led to significant harm to our rivers. Major fish kills and all kinds of aquatic life was destroyed, including waterfall. So those are kind of two of the seminal events in the early 60s that led to us being called the Pollution Control Agency. We're kind of unique across the country among my peers. I think we're the only state agency that has the word pollution in it. Most of the other state agencies that exist across the country are either involved in environment or environmental protection or a form of that terminology, but the Pollution Control Agency was preceded by a Water Pollution Control Board in the state of Minnesota that helped implement programs to improve our sewer systems across the state, and so I think we had that pollution word was part of the legacy in the statutes, and that's how come it wound up in our agency's title. We also think a lot and work diligently on clean water, and we get funding from several sources to help us do the work that supports healthy aquatic ecosystems and healthy communities and strong economy. Just a word here, we do not implement the Safe Drinking Water Act in the state. That is implemented by the Department of Health. And so much of the work we do is to prevent harm to our drinking water supplies, either groundwater or surface water. But the requirements for the Safe Drinking Water Act, that is the federal law, are implemented by the Minnesota Department of Health, the place I used to work. And they're the ones who assure safe drinking water in our communities and in our homes. We also support efforts so that Minnesotans and the agency can take actions to protect air, land, and water, and that has to do significantly with our solid waste work and recycling and waste minimization work that goes on across our state and our businesses to reduce the impacts of toxic materials on our environment and just the burden of solid waste that that we all generate. Lastly, we do the best we can to be excellent in everything we do. We have a very long and proud history of adopting Six Sigma and lean practices in the agency, starting in the 90s, actually, and really taking greater shape in the early 2000s. Previous administrations have done an excellent job of setting the agency on a path of excellence in our operations, and so we're very we aim to be very efficient and very effective at our work. I wanted to talk just quickly about our citizens board. This is one of the unique or interesting elements of our agency, which has to do with the citizens board is actually a decision-making body in the statute, and the statute says that the agency is the board and the board is the agency. And that can sound a little confusing, but many of the decisions of the agency are delegated to staff through the commissioner. About 99% of the agency's decisions are delegated to the staff. Most of the things that come to the board are significant decisions related to environmental review processes, large permit decisions, and rules or variances to rules that must be approved by the citizens board. The board is appointed by the governor, and as I said, they make those sorts of decisions that I just described. They meet one day a month unless we don't have any business conduct, and then we don't meet. And I chair the board. And just quickly, I thought I would let you know who the members of our board are so that you understand the nature of our citizen board members. Our longest serving board member, Dr. Dan Foley, is a medical doctor and is a toxicologist by training. He's been on the board for 35 years. He's been reappointed consistently over those years, and his interest is in human health and the risks of exposure to chemicals and hazards in the environment. Dr. Kathy Drager is the agricultural representative on the board. The statutes require that one of our board members be a representative knowledgeable in agriculture, and Dr. Drager operates a farm with her husband and family in Traverse County, and she's also employed by the University of Minnesota in their Rural Sustainable Development Partnership efforts. Dr. Carolyn Sampson is a PhD chemist and was employed by General Mills to operate their environmental laboratories for a number of years. She's now retired from that position and is teaching at a local community college. And she serves, again, on our board as an expert in water and chemistry. Dennis Jensen is a board member from Duluth, Minnesota. Dr. Sampson is from the metro area, and Dr. Foley is also from the metro area. Dennis Jensen is our board member who is the administrative officer of the Duluth Transit Authority. He has been on the board for about 8 years now, and he is has a very capable interest in administrative matters as well as the interests of the Duluth community. Ms. Paku Hang is a board member who works for immigrant farmers, Southeast Asian immigrant organic farmers. She coordinates a cooperative network of those farmers, and she's been on the board, I think, about 3 years. Jim Riddle is a member on our board and is from Winona, Minnesota. He is was formerly an elected member of the Winona Soil and Water Conservation Board. He's no longer a board member, but he is active in soil and water conservation efforts, and he operates a farm, an organic berry farm in Winona County called Blue Fruit Farms. Mr. Ernest Morgan is the most recent appointment to our board, and Mr. Morgan is a business executive who works for Emerson Companies, heating and cooling system control devices company that is Twin Cities based, and Mr. Morgan is a senior vice president in that organization. And we have one board member position that's vacant, and that is the position on our board that's responsible for being knowledgeable in labor, and that's a original requirement of the statute that we have someone who represents knowledgeable interests in labor. Mr. David Ibarra was our most recent board member in that position, and Mr. Ibarra had to step off the board because of conflicts with other duties that he was fulfilling. So we will be there will be a new appointment to that vacant position at some point in the future. And Mr. Chair, after I make my presentation, I'd be happy to come back and answer questions if that's acceptable. Thank you. Our regional, we have, as I said, we have about 900 employees, and we have about 200 of those employees are located outstate in regional offices in Detroit Lakes, Brainerd, Duluth, Wilmer, Marshall, Mankato, and Rochester. Our staff who work in the field offices are the ones who do some of our watershed assessment work, where it's most efficient for them to go out and get in our streams and lakes and gather data more efficiently that way. Certainly we have a large water monitoring crew out of our Brainerd office that covers a large share of the northern part of the state. Our Wilmer office is the place where we handle a lot of our feedlot permitting, and same with our Mankato office. So we try to locate our staff in places that are appropriate to the work, where the clientele are that deal with us. The rest of our employees, about 600 to 700 of us, work in the St. Paul office, and we have an organizational structure that looks very hierarchical, but I will tell you it is not. It's a very matrix-based system of accomplishing our work. We have 7 divisions here. I'll quickly cover what's in each of these divisions. The industrial division handles industrial permitting for industrial wastewater facilities, so things like major businesses that have a discharge to our rivers or lakes, the stormwater permits that are managed there, and our air permitting for industrial sources. Our watershed division does the watershed assessment across the state, the 81 watersheds of Minnesota that we actively monitor and support activities. They also are the division that handles our feedlot permitting. The municipal division is municipal wastewater facilities, and also our, I hate this term, SSTS, the subsurface sewage treatment systems program. I still like to think of it as sewage treatment systems, septic tanks and drain fields and all the things that work on your land for individual sewage treatment. And then our remediation division is the folks that handle site cleanup, assessing sites that have been contaminated and need some remedial efforts to clean up contaminated soil or groundwater. And our environmental analysis and outcomes division is a very scientifically based group of folks who work on setting standards for our environment, for air quality, for land and soil, for water quality. And so these folks work to define how we're going to perform, how we're going to set limits and permits based on what kinds of environmental outcomes are desired to have clean water, clean air, or restored land and soil. Resource Management and Assistance Division works on our solid waste permitting, so they handle all of the landfills that are permitted in the state. They also deal with our resource recovery and recycling programs, so they focus heavily on solid waste management, recycling, as well as supporting efforts in small businesses to reduce their impact by reducing toxic materials that are used in business processes. They also support businesses, small businesses that are aiming to be more effective and efficient at reducing their environmental impact. Our last division is operations, and that is pretty classically the folks who deal with our financing and our financial impact work, as well as the human resource work. And that's also where we do we have a small group who help the agency work on continuous improvement out of that office. Today, our budget overview will try to focus on these four themes. One is we want to continue to do our watershed-based work to water quality efforts. As I said, there are 81 major watersheds across the state of Minnesota. Our efforts using clean water funds and some other funds is to assess water quality and to create a solid baseline of information so that we can measure the future impacts of work and of our economy and our efforts as a state. The second is to promote and protect human health by addressing new and emerging challenges that can create health risks in our populations. You'll hear a little bit about some air quality issues and some toxic materials in our environment and in our in human use that we want to promote and address. The third area would be improving the transparency of our work, including citizen and business access to environmental data to assist with project timeliness. And this is, you know, that the governor and the legislature in 2011 set a 150-day goal for permits to be issued, those permits that lead to job creation and job growth in Minnesota. We're currently performing very well at that. We're about 98% of those permits are issued within 150 days. And last year, the governor and the legislature moved forward with a 90-day permit goal for projects and for permits that do not have such extensive environmental review or public comment periods. And we're going to be issuing our first report on that 90-day goal this coming August. So one way that we want to invest is to do a better job of accelerating and providing access to citizens and business to the data sets that we need for making decisions on permits and for reporting on environmental quality. Our last overall statement is the budget is a 1% increase overall across all funds. And as Assistant Commissioner Kadelka and our Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Mueller, will present, the agency has very little general fund. We operate out of other funding sources to accomplish our work. But with that, and before we transition, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer some questions before I need to leave for another commitment.
Commissioner, what's your timing? How long are you available?
It'd be great, Mr. Chair, if I could be leaving around 9 a.m.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, back to the Citizens Board. Can you let me know, do they have any, you said they're the agency and the agency is the board. Do they have any authority in the hiring and firing of any of the employees?
Mr. Chair, they do not. Those decisions are made and delegated to the commissioner and the administrative part of the work of the agency. The board members do not engage in hiring and disciplinary actions.
Thank you. And did you say it's 9 members?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. There are 8 appointed members, and then I'm appointed by the governor as well. So I guess we're all appointed by the governor. But right now we have 7 of our positions filled. Obviously, I'm in my position. We have one, the labor representative position, that's not filled at the present time.
Thank you, Commissioner. And can you remind me how it works as far as Robert's rules? What's a quorum requirement? And then the protocol for roll call votes.
Mr. Chair, the board does operate using Robert's rules, so we have a quorum when we have a majority of members present. And so that is, we, in order for a decision to be effective, we have to have a majority of the board approving. So if there were a smaller number of members present, sometimes we'd have to adjust what a majority of the board means for a decision. So if there are six members present, we would need five members voting in the affirmative to pass a resolution or a motion. Roll call decisions are made in, first of all, any decision that comes before the board is briefed to the board in a very thorough packet. So there's a background memo that explains the topic that's being presented to the board. And if the board needs to make a decision, then there are documents that lay out the background of the issue, and then findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a resolution of the board that's recommended by the staff of the agency. Those documents can be rather lengthy. They generally include public input that's been provided in the process of reviewing a permit application, for example, or a rule, or a variance, or a environmental review decision. So we get often the packet that our board members receive is pretty weighty, and then the staff walk through the resolution and the proposal that they're making to the board. The board then has a deliberative process where they ask questions of the staff. We also take testimony then in our board meetings. We allow citizens to be heard. We also take testimony from the party seeking approval from the board, if that's in a permit action or a variance decision, for example. And the board then, after taking testimony, evaluates all of that information, deliberates, and makes a decision. And if a roll call is made, I call the roll, and we call each person by name, and the vote is taken.
Commissioner, thank you. You said if a roll call is called. How is that decided if a roll call is called or not?
When there's a decision item before the board, it's been my practice, Mr. Chair, to just have a roll call vote. If it's an information item, obviously we're not taking up a decision, so there's no vote. When we're making resolutions or we're adjusting resolutions, we'll take a verbal vote on specific resolutions that might tweak a few provisions of our findings of fact or our conclusions of law. So we have taken verbal votes of the board on those procedural matters, much like happens in committee in the legislature. But when it comes to the actual decision of the board, then we take a roll call vote.
So, Commissioner, if I understand you right, then it would take five members voting in the affirmative on a roll call basis to adopt action by the board?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Commissioner.
Morning.
You alluded to in your operations division that that division looks at continuous improvement processes in your agency. Could you expand on that a little bit, what you're doing for that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum. Yes, for example, the agency has been systematically mapping out all of our business processes. So we have, as does any organization, you have a business process for reviewing a permit, you have a business process for conducting environmental review, we have a business process for how we develop a standard, for how we process a variance request. I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of business processes, and one of the efforts of our agency is to map all of those and actually create a diagram of the business process so that then when we want to look at how business processes can be improved, we can put those all on the wall like you would in a lean process and map it out and look for the opportunities to improve it. That's one example. That staff of that division also support the work of our managers to conduct lean processes, so they're actually some of the coaches that we have internally. They help train our managers and our employees on lean processes and Six Sigma practices. One of our trainings this year is on daily work tools that you can bring to your daily work on Six Sigma and lean processes so that you better implement your work at your desk every day or in the field every day. So those are some examples of what our continuous improvement staff do. And if you have further questions, Kathy Moger, the division director for our operations division, is here, and she can answer those perhaps a little later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One further question is, well, with these lean processes and following Six Sigma, which is a big buzzword nowadays, have you been able to achieve any efficiencies in terms of reducing overhead costs, even headcount?
Commissioner Link Stein.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, you can call me Commissioner Stein because Link is my middle name. That's another thing. I should have explained that earlier. So Link.
Go ahead. You got time.
I am. My family calls me Link, and so to my family and friends that I grew up with, they call me Link. And when I went to the university, they don't like middle names. I found out they like your first name only. And so I got started being called John then, and it sort of stuck. I kind of liked having two lives. So I had my family life and my professional life. But I go by John as my first name or Commissioner Stein. Evidently, my mother did not like Link as a first name, or it would have been the other way around. And my sisters were 9 and 10 when I was born, and they voted to call me Link, but to make it my middle name. And my sister refuses to answer what kind of vote there was in the family at the time to make that decision. But it was it's not a hyphenated last name. I just put all three of them down because all my friends from high school know me as Link. And when things come out about the agency's work, I just want to make sure they know it's me.
Mr. Stein, do you remember Representative Buglum's follow-up question?
I do.
Go ahead.
Chair, we have been able to, Mr. Representative Buglum, we have been able to manage many of our processes without having to solicit additional funds or additional staff. One in particular that we're working on now is our transformation of our old permitting databases. We have systems where we process permitting information, environmental data, and watershed data, all of which are helpful to us in making permit decisions. We have 30 to 50 databases that were built in the mid-90s. They're now getting to be 20 years old. We were able to mobilize 42 of our agency personnel to work on transforming those business processes without soliciting additional funds. And continuing to do the work of the agency while those business processes were realigned. And so that's one example of how we've been able to be efficient and make improvement. And that those efforts are now leading to the implementation of a new, more online-based permitting database that you'll hear more about later in the budget presentation. It is important that we modernize our systems because our customers want to have access to their data online. They want to be known as a single entity in our data systems because many companies and municipalities receive multiple approvals from the agency, and they want to not have to re-enter or reapply for that information all the time. So those are some of the things we're working on right now, and as an example of how we've been able to make improvements without soliciting additional resources.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Uglum.
No follow-up. Thank you, Link.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner. I'm curious, on the Citizens Board, how is it decided that a proposed project is going to come before the Citizens Board?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, it is laid out in rule what categories of activities require the Board's approval, and there are some in the law and in our rules, the Board members are authorized to bring a matter before the Board if they so choose. So any Board member has the ability to solicit a project or a proposal come before the Board. That happens very infrequently. But there are categories of environmental review actions that are required to come before the board. When we're making a determination on an environmental assessment worksheet, whether it is does not require an EIS or does require an EIS, that's part of environmental review that happens all the time. Those decisions come before the board. There are also decisions related to size and scope of permit activities that come before the board. And so, as I said, I've looked back over the last 12 years. The average number of decisions that the board makes in a given year is about 10 to 12.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when an action comes before the board, is the proposer then appearing in front of the board as well?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes. Most often that is the case. There are some matters that where, for one reason or another, a business owner or party may not choose to appear, but in my experience in the last 4 years, the project sponsor, the project proponent, always appears before the board.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So where in the process is a proposer aware of the possibility that their project is going to be coming before the Citizens Board?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, it depends on the process, but I would say as soon as we know, the project sponsor knows. So if we understand that a board member may be bringing a matter by referral to the board, we let the project sponsor know that. If we know it's a decision that leads to a board or a proposal that leads to a board action, we tell the project sponsor that right at the beginning of the process.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, at the it would seem to me that there should be some documentation for a proposer when they go to the business one stop over at the deed office, that this is the possibility. Does that exist there?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I don't know if there's anything in writing that we give to that project's proposer, but we do notify them verbally, and Mr. Smith, who one of our division directors here today, can maybe give you a little bit more background on that in future. However, when we work with a business proponent through Minnesota Business First Stop, which is a collection of agencies organized through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, we aim to give them as much assistance to get through the regulatory process as possible. And if we can guide them to a method of operating their business or a set of practices that they could use to avoid a decision that might come before the board, we certainly do that. But if we know that it's going to need to come before the board, we would tell them that during that process.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, why would you not have something in writing so throughout the permitting process they know that this is a possibility and these are the possible triggers? I think that that's something that, I mean, to me it's one of those things that should be there, and sure, all of a sudden this gets sprung on them and they go, well, how did this happen? I think that you owe it to the state of Minnesota to have that as part of your written documentation at the very beginning of the permitting process. Why would you not do that?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Stein.
And Representative Fabian, I think when we're working with a business owner in Business First Stop or in the early stages of permitting, it might be before they've submitted a permit application, because they're still actually trying to decide how they want to operate their proposed project. So more often what I'm describing is in that early pre-permit application phase of the decision making, where we're working with a business owner, we're guiding and advising them with folks from other agencies. It's hard to put things in writing at that stage of the process because their mind could change and the project might change dramatically. So we wouldn't want to mislead anybody that says we now know what you need to do before you've made the decision. Once they've made the decision, they've applied for a permit, we can certainly notify them in writing that this would be a matter that would normally come to the board.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you mentioned that if a board member decides that they want to bring a matter to the Citizens Board, what about when the agency is contemplating doing that? I mean, even at the time that you start contemplating the possibility of bringing this to the board, do you notify the proposer at that point, or do you wait until you've actually made the final decision to go to the Citizens Board?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, in my experience, I've talked to business owners as soon as I know. So I have actually notified maybe a handful of the parties I've dealt with in the last 4 years, giving them the verbal heads up as soon as I know that that's a possibility.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, I have a couple questions that they follow along the line of the Citizens Board. You said they make about a dozen, 10, 12 decisions annually, I think you said. In your time there in recent history, and if somebody in the audience needs to help, how many times has the board, do you always have a agency position on what comes before the board that you make a recommendation for or against? And how often does the board have discussion and then reverse or take action, or don't they ever take action different than your recommendation?
Mr. Chair, there's every time a matter is brought before the board, the agency presents a recommended resolution and a position, so to speak, for the board. And that is the substance of the packet that we give to the board members. It lays out the reasons for the recommendation. And in my experience, there have been, I can recall in the last year, one decision that went against the agency's recommendation. And prior to that, I'd have to ask the staff to fill in the details. So I don't think there have been. I'm looking at my Deputy Commissioner, Michelle Beeman. She's telling me there has not been a decision where the board overruled the recommendation of the agency. I will say that there have been many times when the board has modified specific details of the action that the agency will take in modifying findings, in emphasizing specific provisions of a regulatory approval on a permit. I can recall a couple of decisions where the board said, we have, you know, we're approving this consistent with the agency's recommendation. However, we want to have a report back from a business or from a community in a certain period of time. There have been a couple of those. There's been more those sorts of, I would call them adjustments to the agency's decision rather than outright change, you know, change in direction of the agency's decision.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and I'm trying to understand this process. So it's nine citizen members. You laid out very well how they come from different backgrounds and such, and basically it looks like folks that have an interest in this in some background, maybe other ones maybe have specific interests in agendas of their own and the direction the state could take and how they got on the board or why they're there. I'm not sure I understand or would agree with. Especially, let me understand a little better. Is there a process when these projects come before the Citizens Board? The public can come before the Citizens Board and testify. So if you have a proposer, people interested in that as the public could come and testify before the Citizens Board, who it sounds like have the ultimate authority to make a decision about this. Has the public ever had a chance to have input in that process prior to that day at the Citizens Board?
Mr. Chair, yes. Depending upon the decision and the process that leads up to it, often there is public input prior to the day of the board meeting itself. There have been, in the case of environmental review processes, there usually are at least one public meeting in the community where a project is proposed. There are other processes where public meetings are involved for specific types of permits that go through public notice procedures, and those are required under the federal laws that we implement for our permitting programs. And so, yes, often citizens have had an opportunity to attend one of those meetings. We've had in our board meeting discussions, as the chair, have the decision-making on how citizen input is provided at the board meeting, how long people can speak at the board meeting. We require people to identify themselves. It's very similar to this process, Mr. Chair. We want to know who people are, where they're from, what's their particular interest. We take testimony, and if the testimony is significant, I have to limit the time that people get to speak.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, do you, as the chair of the board, have the authority to table the motion before the group?
I don't know, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, you can get back to me.
I'll let you know.
On that. Commissioner, along those lines, do the citizen members have any obligation to the agency if they don't think they would be able to agree with the position? I'm trying to understand hundreds and hundreds of employees within MPCA, and I'm just looking at the 14 or 15 of you that are in the audience today and their vast experience the thoughtfulness that your agency puts into something. I'm trying to understand if this group, which is only required to have six individuals from a variety of backgrounds, no professional requirement at all for them to make a decision, and it sounds like it can be a unilateral decision. I would imagine there's a court appeals process, but I guess I would like to understand better the logic of this. It seems like, I often visit with Mr. Merritt, who has a long history with the agency, dealing back when I was a college student and there was scary things happening in this state, and I often say you didn't dare go in the Mississippi River when I was a kid. We're much better today. We have a process much better. And I don't think this process is serving the state correctly today. I would like to know what your authority is. I think there's a real responsibility. I don't know if the citizen members have an obligation, but I think this needs a lot of work, and I'm really, really troubled where it's at. This is not similar things in DNR or Bowser and other agencies in our purview, and we need to fix this. This is broken. This is broken. There's not a good process here, and I would like to see us work together to get it fixed. Are they, the members, subject to the open meeting laws, similar to like members of Lasard SAMS are in limiting the conversations between the citizen board members? Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, yes, they are.
Thank you.
And if I could comment, Mr. Chair.
I would ask you to, and I apologize, you are a couple minutes over, and I probably now, with my points, probably have some folks that want to make points with you in the room. So if you're okay, I hope you can stay for a few more minutes. Commissioner Stein.
Thank you. I'll be happy to stay for a few more minutes, Mr. Chair. I do want to differ with your opinion that the board is broken. I find that the board adds value to the deliberations of the agency and to the quality of the agency's work. In my experience, board members come with a very serious attention to the work that they're doing. They understand that the staff of the agency, you know, worked in many cases their whole career on developing their skill and their technical abilities in the work that we do. And it isn't been my experience that the board members take off on tangents to specifically go after the work of our staff. We ask, when I meet with board members, when a board member is appointed, the commissioner's office meets with new board members, and we provide them with two things. One is sort of a history of the board and the board's decision-making roles. We also give them a packet of legal information about their duty as a board member and what they're bound by under the, you know, state ethical practices, ethical conduct laws, and other procedural responsibilities of being a board member. And my experience has been that the board members ask very sound questions. They question our staff, they question the project proponents, and they question the public when they present before the board. And much like my early career when I worked with city councils and county boards on zoning ordinance decisions, those processes can become tense, they can become emotional, and yet when board members take their duty seriously, it leads to stronger decisions. So having said that, having worked in two other agencies that don't have boards, I have found it to be a very positive experience to have a group of citizens, colleagues of mine on a board to question and inquire of all those parties I mentioned earlier to find better solutions and to improve our own work. So while I respect your opinion, I disagree.
Commissioner, I look forward to working with you on the issue. Representative Clark.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and this is a totally different issue. I was looking at the budget overview. And I'm just wondering, one of the things that you mentioned in looking at the budget overview was each of those four categories. I'm wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit on the Protect Human Health by Addressing New Types of Challenges. And the reason I want to ask that is because I know you work with the Department of Health, but there's certain things that we have to rely on PCA to do. And so I think it's one of the really important goals that you have. Could you just maybe briefly, I know you don't have much time, but addressing new types of challenges, what are you referring to there?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we are in our budget proposing a couple of areas where we think it's important to address challenges. One is on Superfund sites and old cleanup sites where we have contaminants, especially volatile organic compounds that are in groundwater. Once upon a time, the solution to that was to pump the groundwater to the surface, expose it to the atmosphere, and the volatile organics would evaporate and blow away in the wind, and then that would reduce the concentration of those organic compounds in the groundwater. And the purpose of doing that was to bring the groundwater to a level of below a level of concern for those contaminants. What we've learned subsequent to that is those sites now are those organic compounds are migrating up through the soil. So where you have basements lying above those contaminated sites, we have found migration of those volatiles up through the soil, and so you'll hear about soil vapors and contamination because of soil vapors. Minneapolis has had a significant site that we've been working with General Mills to address in the Southeast Como neighborhood over the last 2 years. There are areas around the state now as we've gone back to look at these sites, the sites that apparently keep on giving to our contamination risk. That's one. The second health challenge we want to address is expanding our work in under the Toxic Free Kids Act, and that is to do a better job of informing the citizens using reporting requirements for anyone who produces, manufactures, or distributes products that contain or use one of the listed priority chemicals that we in the health department identify as a concern for children's health. Those are the two areas that we're proposing to increase.
Follow up, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess one of the other areas that I'm aware of that you have been working on, and it's probably not a new challenge, but I think it's a challenge that needs some more work, and that's the whole area of environmental justice. And I want to compliment you on, hiring someone whose job it is to really look at that disproportionate impact of toxic chemicals in a community based on income and race. And so I want to compliment you on your hiring Mr. Brooks to do that work. But my understanding is we still don't have funding to do some of the monitoring that we need to do. For example, I know we passed legislation a couple years ago that did some air monitoring in a number of areas. It was supposed to be around the state, and I think there's still parts of the state, especially in greater Minnesota, where I think those monitors still need to go, and in other parts of more concentrated areas too. So I just want to mention that, Mr. Chairman. I won't go into it because I know it's just an overview, but I think in terms of the challenges, I'd just like to add that, and then thank you for your work on the other.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. We will connect with you on that matter.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to speak in terms of my own experience with the Citizen Board and why I think it's a very important part of the agency. Some 22 years ago, I was in an effort working with some citizens in Dakota County. The county board at that time was proposing a garbage incinerator that was the most expensive project in county history at that time. And there was a really open and transparent process at the board citizens were able to testify at hearings. I believe they even had a field hearing or two related to this. The commissioner at the time, Mr. Williams, saw that this was so controversial and the public was so interested that they even extended the public comment time. And at the end of the day, the Citizens Board, I believe, made the correct decision in denying the permit. It saved the taxpayers, you know, at that time it was over $150 million. That's 1992 dollars, so that would be even more expensive now. So we had a good taxpayer outcome and a good environmental outcome. And I just don't think that would have been possible if we had a much more closed, only staff-directed exclusive process. So in terms of the, I think our issue was raised earlier about the citizen involvement. Are citizens involved in these deliberations? And I could say unequivocally yes, and it really improved the outcome. So I think it's an important institution, and I hope we can keep it that way.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And last year, I've become familiar with a term that I hadn't heard before, and it was called regulatory capture. And that's a term that was first used in the financial industry, where the people who are being regulated become so comfortable with the people that are regulating them that objectivity disappears. And I think that this whole discussion on the Citizens Board, you know, at best, some Minnesotans may think that something that was done in the 70s is quaint and outdated. Mm-hmm. At worst, they may think that it just its time is gone. I think as having been here 10 years and looking at things we've passed, both sides of the aisle, we tend to institutionalize stakeholder involvement in boards now, more than we did in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. We actually write into statute special interests being on boards rather than having citizens be on boards, rather than having that objectivity of just regular Minnesotans. And I think if anything, if we talk to our constituents, regular Minnesotans get it. They get what's happened. They get that it's often the powerful or the connected that have a seat at the table rather than them. And so having citizens involved, and what is that level of involvement, I think, is important. But I think we as a legislature and as a government have to look at how we are writing special interests into decision-making all the time here with boards and commissions, and what the role should be, whether it should be Minnesotans who are there at a board saying what's best for Minnesota versus people being on board saying, what's the piece of the pie that I get for my interest, or what is my interest going to want out of this decision? That's a bigger discussion, so I'd be happy if we have that discussion. Because I think there is bills in front of us now, there have been bills in the past. What is the best way to involve Minnesotans in a decision, rather than just involving the people who are paid to be there to represent that thing? And Mr. Chair, you know, in the past, I've offered on some of these boards amendments to say no lobbyists should serve. I think lobbyists could serve on the Citizens Board. I don't think they should, because they have a different role if they're representing that. So we need to talk about how we involve Minnesotans rather than how we involve stakeholders. And what happens here, I know there's plenty of people that are upset with a decision. That's why we're having this discussion. But I think we should talk about the process and who is involved in making decisions and how we can better that for Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Commissioner Stein.
Because of the commentary, what I propose to do is provide you with background information about our board, about the appointment process, the statutes under which they operate, the rules under which they operate, and then a history of our decision-making, if that would be helpful to the committee.
And, Mr. Stein, I think most helpful along that line would be the history. What was the public opportunity from the 70s, 80s, the 90s that Representative Hornstein talked about, a very important decision in my county that, thank goodness, the correct decision was made by the Citizens Board? Unfortunately, I'm not sure that's where we're at today. And I think we need to review where we're at, and I think with good people on all sides of this issue, we can make it better. It clearly, we may differ on the opinion of what exactly will make it better, but I guess I don't want to belabor the point, but I do look forward to moving forward. Last question on this. Oh, I'm sorry, I have two more. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point on the information on the Citizens Board, I would appreciate getting a map of the state of Minnesota. It shows me where the Citizens Board members live.
We'll do that, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian will include that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. That was one of my questions. Representative Fabian, a minute ago the word environmental justice came up. Is that something that's defined in statute, or is it in your rulemaking, or is that an internal policy, and how do you apply that?
Commissioner Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, there is not a statutory definition of environmental justice to my knowledge. The EPA has efforts which are organized under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, in part which is to assure that there is no discrimination in the programs that the EPA funds and is responsible for implementing. And so under the Civil Rights Act, part of that is providing assurance of equal access to decision-making processes, that the funding is administered in ways that meet the Title VI requirements of the Civil Rights Act. And an outgrowth of that conversation has been when agencies are required to do public meetings, for example, and are there equal opportunities for access to public meetings. And some of the challenges, as we've found, is that people don't all have computers, people don't all have transportation opportunities that can bring them to a meeting. So one of the challenges in addressing those disproportionate conditions in our society is to try to reach out in a more equitable way. So the principles behind environmental justice are meaningful involvement of all citizens, regardless of race, color, creed, or location, and so I said meaningful involvement and equitable treatment. Those are the two kind of high-level principles of environmental justice, and as we look at then the past, agencies' decision-making and the conditions in our communities, as Representative Clark noted, there are places where the past has led to some disproportionate health risk exposures, where various populations and subgroups of populations of income or of color or of ethnicity are at greater risk of exposure to certain compounds than other places. So those are the practices and principles. As Representative Clark noted, we're working on that as to how we can, within the Civil Rights Act, duties that the agency has in delegation from the EPA, address those in a systematic and effective way so that all citizens of the state benefit from the work.
Follow up, Representative Dill.
No.
Representative Clark, to this point.
Mr. Chairman, just a little historical review.
Sure. Representative Clark.
The first President Bush introduced us to the word environmental justice and appointed a task force. That was followed by President Clinton, by President Bush, and by President Obama. This has been an ongoing discussion of the issues that was just described, I think, pretty well. But so the federal definition or the federal explanation has evolved and come to our states, and that's what we've used, and that's what I understand. I just wanted people to know, because I think sometimes it might seem like this is a new word. It's not. It's been around for like four presidents.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark. Commissioner Stein, thank you. We look forward to working with you. And I believe Assistant Commissioner Kodalka and Chief Financial Officer Mueller will come forward and continue on with the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you for coming. And sorry we kept you late. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, that would be great.
Mr. Chair and members,
could you identify yourself for the record, please?
This is Lyle Mueller. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the MPCA.
Proceed.
This morning, I'm going to be presenting a number of slides, and some of these you saw a couple of weeks ago. When we were here last, a couple of weeks ago, it was at a point in time where where we could not yet discuss the governor's budget for the coming biennium. And so what we've done is even though some of these slides may look familiar, we've added the budget plan for the coming 2 years. And we'll also be talking about our budget requests as part of the plan as well. So first, we'll just as a review, take a look at our budget picture over a period of time. This is a 10-year view. A couple of things that are noteworthy include kind of what's happened to our funding from the general fund, which has increased significantly over this time frame. Back in 2008 and 2009, our general fund made up about 15% of our budget. In the current years, 16 and 17, our general fund is now a little bit greater than 3% of our funding mix. As you can see, the environmental fund, which is the green part of the bar, the remediation fund, have remained fairly constant. What was new starting in fiscal 10 was the creation, or the first year that we had appropriations from the Clean Water Fund. And so starting in fiscal 10 and continuing through the current. And again, as Commissioner Stein noted, overall our budget picture is about 1% greater than our authorized budget for fiscal year 14 and 15. Next. Taking a look at FTE, we've arrayed this by fund. And we've also noted a couple of kind of larger changes or significant changes in our funding or FTE in our history. So back in fiscal years 2008 and 2009, the agency was growing with the addition of new funding to carry out the responsibilities under Minnesota's Clean Water Legacy Act. We added staffing in 8 and 9. We also added a number of positions that were specifically intended to address issues around the mining and ethanol sectors of the economy. Skipping ahead to fiscal year 2012, the first few weeks of that particular fiscal year were the government shutdown, and you can see how that significantly decreased our FTE count in that particular fiscal year. There was also a point in time, remember, the economy was in a downturn in fiscal years 9 through 11, continuing into 12. In fiscal 12, we offered what was known as an ERI, early retirement incentive, and there were roughly 20 employees within the agency who accepted that early retirement incentive plan and left at that point in time. Next. What we'll be spending time on today.
Representative Fabian,
thank you,
question.
Commissioner. Question on the early retirement incentive. When you make those offers, do you consult with the state pension funds where these employees would be drawing from to make sure that they're comfortable with your decision to do that,
Mr. Miller? Mr. Chair and Representative, when we offer the early retirement incentive, it is a plan that's drawn up, and we work closely with MMB. It needs to be a plan that is approved by MMB. My understanding is that yes, they are connecting with what other interests kind of need to be brought into the conversation.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, I personally, I would like, some more assurance on that. If we could get some information from MMB and the pension people, just to make sure that those pension boards are being consulted before the final decisions are made. Thank you.
Thank you. Continue on with your testimony.
As we work our way through the presentation this morning, Mr. Chair and members, you'll be hearing more about our individual budget change requests, but to kind of bring it all together into one slide, into one place. We've listed our various change items. We've also arrayed them by funding source. And while you can drop to the bottom of the page in the total and see that our total request is $69,720,000, if you back up to our request under the Clean Water Fund, you'll see that the bulk of our new request is our Clean Water Fund request. And as you're aware of from either previous years or listening to the presentations from other agencies, this is common across all of the legacy funds that the appropriations are made on a biennial basis. They do not become part of the base or carry over, so we come back to you as a committee and present what our new request will be for the next biennium. Just giving a quick comparison, both between the previous biennium, again, as we said, this budget request for 16 and 17 is a very modest request over our authorized budget for 14 and 15. We've arrayed this by fund. You can see where the increases, decreases are, and the differences. Next. Again, a graphic that you've seen before, taking arraying our entire budget request by fund and amount. What I'd like to do from this slide is to spend just a little more time on two particular funds, and that would be our Environmental Fund, which is the green slice of the pie, and the Remediation Fund, the purple slice of the pie. So kind of going around the circle, some of these funds are essentially self-explanatory. You know where the revenues for the general fund, where they come from, and by and large how they're dispersed across state government. The next one is the Clean Water Fund. Just as a reminder, that's 0.625% of the sales tax. So all of that revenue comes from that percentage of the sales tax. As I said, we're going to get into a little more detail on the next two funds. Federal funds, the fundamental funding source is general tax revenues, but on the federal basis that eventually work their way back to us in a series of grants. And for us, our primary granting connection with the federal government is through EPA. I'd say 99% of our grants come to us through EPA. So next, looking at specifically at the Environmental Fund, the receipts into the fund include the biggest one in the mix is the solid waste management tax. Currently at 57%. Next category is our series of fees on regulated parties. This would be the permits and fees encompassing air, water. There's a number of categories or a number of specific fees in that category.
Thank you, Representative Hugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner. The motor vehicle transfer fee of $18.7 million, what's the reason for that your agency gets money for that?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, the motor vehicle transfer fee is a fee on the change in the title of a motor vehicle,
right.
So everything from purchase to sale of a used vehicle. There is a long history of that particular fee coming to the Environmental Fund, going back to the late 90s. There was a couple of years where that particular fee was deposited to the general fund, and then starting in fiscal either 8 or 9, it came back again, deposited fully to the Environmental Fund. Back in its history, there was a connection between the motor vehicle transfer fee and spending on scrap yards and waste tire cleanup. Over a period of time, that specific connection was, let's say, blurred, and it no longer is obviously connected to waste tires or tire cleanup.
And Mr. Mueller, maybe this is for one of the other folks, could come down and answer. That's my understanding. The original intent, decades ago, we had a real challenge with used tires, and unfortunately, they didn't have any value at that time, and they were accumulating everywhere and were really bad in the environment, for no other reason than they were a real bad spot for mosquitoes to collect. So what's the history, trying to understand, and if I remember right, it was $1, it was the way it started, and is it now? I believe it's $10, and so this is a tax on motor vehicles, and it comes into the environmental fund. What's the connection and the logic? Does someone have, or where is the money actually going? Assistant Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mueller.
And members, you're absolutely right. The history does go back a couple of decades. My memory is that back in roughly starting in 2000, the fee was $4 for this title transfer, starting in about beginning of fiscal year 2006. The fee was raised to $10 per transaction. While the fee has, as I said, the original connection was to tires and waste tires. This is something that has evolved. When we look at the particular uses that used to be related to this particular transaction, it was scrap yard cleanup and screening. There have been a variety of uses that have been associated with this particular fee. Going back to fund consolidation, where the existence of a separate account for this fee kind of was discontinued, this fee has been brought into the environmental fund as a non-dedicated receipt, meaning it loses its specific identity once it's brought into the fund and can be used for a variety of purposes. Certainly there's a connection to the existence and the miles traveled and the kind of emission connection. And that's the current thinking on that particular fee.
But Mr. Mueller, I appreciate that good perspective. You kind of laid it out pretty well that it was originally designed to deal with tires and junk cars. And the reality today, the tires are used on playgrounds for safe falls when you drop from a higher platform in a playground. They're shredded up where it's applicable and workable, and they're used for different processes. And today we have a very vibrant economy of taking care of the old cars from the junkyards, and we don't have that on the landscape today. So I think it's important to realize this thing has evolved somewhat. To this point, Assistant Commissioner Kadalka, and then we'll go back to Representative Uglem. Assistant Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadalka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm Assistant Commissioner. As mentioned, it really is now the focus of automobiles. When we had the agency overview a while back, Assistant Commissioner Thornton talked about the large impact that we're seeing in air quality, dealing not with the smokestacks and individual businesses, but the vehicles and the way we move around the state. And as a result, the fee source started out dealing with tires and a solid waste issue, but those dollars now, as we move into areas where we need voluntary actions and efforts to improve air quality, those dollars are linked back to that source. The cause of the issue, the emissions from vehicles, are now funding efforts within the agency to tackle those problems.
Thank you. Representative Uglem, did you have additional follow-up?
I did.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, either one. Well, it seems to me that this is, you mentioned that this is a non-dedicated fee. You can, once it goes into the agency, it could be used for various uses. And the air quality is statewide issue and things. I guess my point is, what is the agency doing raking off $18.7 million when we can turn around and put that into roads and bridges, which are so sorely needed in this state? What's your comment on that?
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the decisions of funding the agency is a decision made by the legislature and also the governor, and it's a joint decision. We will be happy to continue to have this conversation. I know transportation will be a large issue this legislative session, and it has not only issues dealing with moving folks around, but also benefits in air quality and in emissions reductions.
To this point, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Kadalka, we talked about the what it was intended for in the first place, and then it's kind of morphed into something different, and you gave some vague generalities about how the money's being used. And to follow up on Representative Uglem's question, does the agency track dollars? So in this motor vehicle transfer fee, I'll say account, do you track the dollars that are taken from that account and how they're used, in some sort of an accounting system that you have within the agency? I'd like a little more transparency on this particular account is what I'm getting at.
Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chair and members, there is no motor vehicle transfer fee account. As I mentioned, it comes into the fund as a non-dedicated receipt. So certainly we can establish exactly what the receipt amount is into the fund, but it is not contained within a specific account.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Mr. Mueller, I'm not sure if I'm confused, but I don't quite understand. The money originally was intended to be used for a fairly specific purpose. Am I correct?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be correct, but going back 15-plus years, and since that time, that specific link or connection has been modified.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by what authority was the motor vehicle fee originally established? I just want to be clear.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and members, I would have to check in our records in order to reestablish that history.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
We represent Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if it was in some sort of legislative action, which is what I understand it to be, and it was expressly designed to be used for fairly specific purposes, how did it morph into something else without the legislative approval?
Assistant
if that's what's going on.
Assistant Commissioner Kadalka.
Committee members, the current fund systems and the Environmental Fund and the Remediation Fund have been set up through a process that was stakeholders and approved by the legislature. This is the way that the revenues come in under statute, is that the revenues come in into the Environmental Fund and as our non-dedicated receipts, as Mr. Mueller mentioned, and then appropriated out by the legislature for the given tasks. We find a benefit to this is that it does allow for the agency to react in a way that when new challenges come up, we can face them in a more nimble way. The legislature can use environmental dollars in the way it sees fits, whether the priority of the legislature and the governor and the agency at that time is an air issue or a water issue. And the ability to track this information, our fund statements track the revenue in, and then also our expenditures. We have future slides also that talk about the various funding sources for our main program areas that do break down how our programs use the dollars. There's just not a direct DNA from the dollar coming in to going out, because that's the way it's designed in statute.
And Commissioner Kadalka, and to represent Fabian, there's a number of funds that no longer are used for what they originally were established for, and the legislature oftentimes has given the agency in the past the authority to use these more broadly or maybe in a new direction. If I'm not mistaken, in one of the future slides, you're going to talk about new authority you want for the petroleum checkoff, that where they have the blink on, not checkoff, but blink on, blink off, 2 cent a gallon gasoline tax is used to remediate for old gas stations, convenience stores, where the tanks needed to be taken out, and rather than put all that obligation on the individual convenience stores and gas stations from years ago, we have a program to deal with that. They're going to come forward with asking for legislative approval to broaden that to now deal with vapors, where the agency is saying it's a new challenge. So whether we agree with it or not, they've been historically given some pretty broad authority, and you can look at it however you, the agency has laid out that this is approximately $20 million, a little south of $20 million that comes in here, and they're going to use it for new challenges, or you could look at it that it's $20 million that's growing from the original dollar to $10 or $4 and worked its way up to $10, and it's a vehicle transfer fee. Every time you buy a vehicle, new or used, $10 is taken and goes into the environmental fund, and so we'll have a good discussion about that. Representative Green, I was worried, is yours to this point or is it a different one? I have a couple people to this point. Representative Green.
Go ahead and let them do their point on this.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. I just want to make sure that it's understood that salvage yards are still highly regulated businesses, and my kids own the biggest one in northwest Minnesota. Ozzy's out of Bemidji, and everything they do is regulated. And so I'm confident that this environmental fund has something to do with that regulation. So I just wanted to make that clear that, you know, we still got plenty of regulation on the tires and the steel, and I hear it in my ear what's going on with the price of steel now. My kids are having a hard time, so thank you.
Okay. Representative Clark, was yours to this point? Representative Clark.
Yes,
go ahead.
Chairman, thank you. Well, one of the things that I think is maybe time for us to do then is to go back and look at the just what was mentioned by Assistant Commissioner Kodaka, which is there is ongoing and new information and more serious information about the impact of motor vehicle pollution on human health in our cities, on our rural areas, wherever there's a lot of freeway or highway traffic. People who live near them are deeply impacted. So I'd like to just say, let's have a review of that again. It sounds like we need to know more why that's still an important application for motor vehicle tax. I also, Mr. Chairman, I want to just bring up something, and I don't know if either of the two witnesses here have any information on it, but I was at a community meeting not too long ago where the discussion came up about the use of old rubber tires in some of our soccer fields and other places where we're, you know, it's supposed to be a good use of it. There's now information or evidence apparently that there's some issues that those tires are a source of some health hazards. And I'd like to know if we know about that, and if not, maybe there's something in this fund that can help us look at that, because it was brought up as a very serious issue, especially for very young kids playing on those surfaces.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark, for bringing that up. I'm actually not aware of that, so I would like if the department would get back to us. I have not heard that issue before, but thank you for that. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to wait till the very end, but I think we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to back up. My first question has to go back to the new FTEs, and it looks like you're going to put on between 2014 and 2017, you're projecting 48 new, according to the chart. And one of the questions I have is, are any of these new FTEs going to be helping out in speeding up the permitting process, or any of them will be permit writers?
Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't at the tip of my fingers have a complete listing of the change in FTE between 14 and 15. We can provide that. The increase in FTE moving forward from 15 through 17, which is a change of either 6 or 7, relates relates to the change items that we are proposing in our new budgets, and so we will be itemizing those as we move through those pages in the presentation.
Assistant Commissioner and Mr. Mueller, if when you come back tomorrow, if maybe you could give us a little more detailed of the breakdown, maybe within divisions of plus and minuses in FTEs, that would be good. Follow-up, Representative Green.
Thank you. Then back to the chart we were on, when you're looking at fees on regulated parties and the other fees as well, I didn't see a breakdown of the increase. Is that too going to be a 1% increase on all the fees that you charge? Is that what you're asking for in the 1% increase in your budget?
Assistant Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there is not decreases in the budget. Will there be one piece? We'll talk about the air appropriation. There's a fee increase that's required by the federal government, which we're asking to be appropriated to use those dollars. But we can go. There is a issue about changing how fees are done in the future, which we can talk about also.
Representative Green. Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurred to me that maybe we ought to be jumping ahead to page 36 because clearly the department is coming with a proposal for restructuring fees, and since that's been a major part of this, I thought maybe it would be helpful for us to know correct what they're proposing is correct inconsistencies and inequities across air, land, and water. So it would be interesting to know. Maybe they're proposing some things that would be helpful for the conversation we're having right now.
Well, thank you, Representative Hausman, and I think what we'll actually do is let them get back on track. A lot of our questions have been jumping ahead. You're correct. So we'll let them run, and why don't you go ahead, and I think what we'll do is go until just a couple minutes before 10 to see if there's any pressing questions, but why don't we let you guys work your way through some of the slides. Continue.
Mr. Chair and members, if there are no more questions on receipts to the Environmental Fund, take a look at expenditures from the Environmental Fund, and kind of moving around the pie chart. What this reflects is, for example, if we're looking at the air program, what we're seeing is the amount of the for funding for the air program that comes from the Environmental Fund. And for the air program specifically, most of its funding is from the Environmental Fund. When you, so by contrast, move down and take a look at the land program, and they're spending at $14 million over the biennium. What that is saying is only a portion of the land program budget is coming from this particular fund. So there are significant differences between our agency programs and how they're funded from the Environmental Fund. The other thing to note before we go to the next slide is that there are a significant amount level of resources that are transferred every year from the Environmental Fund to the Remediation Fund, and we'll be talking about that on the next slide. So once we take a look at the Remediation Fund, and keeping in mind that these two funds are very, very closely related, very closely linked, so when we're looking at the resources that come into the Remediation Fund, you'll see that the largest component of that is the transfer in from the Environmental Fund. The next largest piece is the transfer in of resources from from the Petroleum Fund, rather. Followed by the green slice of the pie, fees and cost recovery receipts, very small slice for penalties, and then the last one is the Metro Landfill Abatement. The use of resources in the Remediation Fund is as follows. We talked about most of the resources in the fund are going to be expended through the PCA's land program, and that's going to be spent on a combination of programs, including the closed landfill program, the Superfund, VIC, Petro remediation, and brownfields are a few examples of the different programs operating in the land program. The other thing to note is that there are other state agencies that receive direct appropriations from the Remediation Fund, and they include the Department of Agriculture, deed for a kind of long-running brownfields grant program, the DNR, Department of Health, and the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Mueller, I think we'll stop at that point and see if we may have questions, and it is at a point where we could take questions. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, the two slides, the one that you currently, the two previous to this, that one and then one more. There you go. The solid waste management tax, how is that assessed and collected? Where does that come
Mr.
from?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is a tax, and there are a couple different rates depending on the type of material that's being disposed of. They're assessed at the landfill sites, assessed on the haulers. Clearly the haulers will turn around and pass that as a cost of doing business on to you and I as consumers. But the actual tax is paid by the haulers at the sites.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's obviously a very large slice of that pie. When I look at the next slide, the Environmental Fund expenditures, I'm curious to know. When I look at the land portion, I get the landfill. Solid waste management tax there, but how does that large slice of that previous slide, that pie, how does that transfer into the Environmental Fund expenditures? It seems to me that those dollars, again, are being used for things that they weren't necessarily intended for.
Commissioner,
can you help? Can you give me some clarity, please?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, just as we talked about with the motor vehicle transfer fee, the solid waste management tax is coming into the Environmental Fund as a non-dedicated receipt. So it can be used for a variety of purposes. As you see on the slide where we're looking at the expenditures, we have expenditures directly for the landfill grant. We also have a significant transfer to the remediation fund and a wide variety of land related and cleanup purposes are being conducted and expended for the remediation fund.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's somewhat confusing to me, I guess I'll say. When these things were started however long ago and they've just kind of they've morphed into something else, and I get all the solid waste management, and we have to do some things with landfills. I understand all of that, but it seems to me that we are maybe disproportionately passing off the costs of a lot of other activities within the agency that are falling on a fairly limited segment of the. I mean, everybody's involved in garbage. I get that, but it's still not being appropriated out of as an expenditure kind of the way I think that it was maybe intended to be, and it's just kind of going into this slush fund and then you take out of there what you want.
Commissioner Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the note is the land dollars being used there and also transferred for remediation programs, which are land programs, cleanup, but a large slice of the environmental assistance are grants that go out to local units of government, which right now is pegged at $17.25 million a year that go out to them for their recycling and other endeavors. But, Representative, you bring up a great point about the balance and the inequities in the system and the sustainability of it. And as Representative Houseman mentioned, we do talk about that, and one of our proposals is to rework that balance and how things are funded to make a little bit better match of those that are using services and what it's being used for from their revenue source. And that's something we will talk about in more depth in the future, but it is a good point, Representative.
And Representative Fabian, and correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner Kadalka or Mr. Mueller or one of those in the audience, this tax in the Metro is about $50. Is it a cubic yard or a ton? They sometimes are equated. It's somewhere in that neighborhood, isn't it, Commissioner Kadalka?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for residential, it's 9.75% of the sales tax of the trash services. For commercial businesses, it is 17% of that price of garbage services. Recycled services are not taxed. And as you mentioned, there are other mechanisms for construction, demolition, and industrial waste where it's a per cubic yard, it's a volume or weight measurement, which is different for those different types of.
Commissioner, maybe I'm missing the boat. Maybe the total average tipping fee at a landfill is $50 a yard, but I thought the fee to dump at a dump or landfill is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 a yard today. And I know part of that is the fee at the landfill to maintain and take care of that and deal with all the bureaucracy there. But the reality, the significant fees that are charged on folks, some of the logic is that if we have a high enough fee, maybe they will not create as much garbage and recycle what they should. And that's the discussion, Representative Fabian. Is this the right thing to do? Because we don't charge more if somebody can afford to pay more for their garbage, other than if they create more garbage. But if you use the logic that somebody of minimal means has the same amount of garbage, if they're living the right kind of lifestyle to recycle as much as they could, and that they pay as much as somebody with substantially more ability to pay. And so it's a tough question, but it's easy sometimes to justify, let's increase the tax on this because it will maybe encourage people to recycle more, and that's a question we'll have going forward. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mueller, I see on your remediation fund expenditures you have a section for the Attorney General. I'm just curious, does the Attorney General handle all of your litigation, or do you have in-house lawyer staff that does something?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the appropriation on the jump ahead one. The appropriation to the Attorney General's office from the mediation fund, this relates specifically to the legal service work that they were doing on insurance recovery. And we expect that effort to be largely in a wind-down mode. So it's very likely that they will not spend much of that resource, although it is technically still on the books, and therefore we show it. To your question about litigation, we still are in an agreement with the AG's office on much of our litigation work.
Do you have staff attorneys, Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we do have a legal services unit in our agency.
And how many FTEs does that have? And how many of them are lawyers? You can get back to us if you don't know.
Mr. Chair, currently, that's a unit that is about four FTEs, four attorneys, and I think there's a legal assistant in the unit as well.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that show up as a separate budget item, or are those costs blended off?
Mr.
Various
Mueller.
Areas.
Mr. Chair and Representative, those costs are not in our budget as a standalone budget item. In many cases, the work that they're providing is directly linked to a specific program area. So, for example, we in one of our budget requests, if you thinking back to the last session, and we brought back that request again this year. There's legal work associated with working on our Superfund sites, and so our request was to add additional staffing to work in that area, as well as an attorney to work on those issues.
Thank you. A follow-up, Representative.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate some more information on how much litigation the department is subject to and how much spending is done in that area. Thank you,
Mr. If you could bring that back to us tomorrow, that'd be great. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Fabian raised an excellent point earlier about, is the money from this landfill fund going to intended purposes. And, you know, I agree that, you know, one of the main areas that we need to beef up is are these grants to counties for, you know, recycling and the SCORE program. But it's also my understanding that some of this is going to the general fund as well. Is that true? How much of this is also going to the general fund?
Commissioner Kodalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the solid waste management tax is split 70-30%, 30% going to the environmental fund. The dollars that are showing up on our piece here are just the portion going into the environmental fund. It's not showing the 30% that's going into the general fund.
Okay. Well, Mr.
Excuse me. Sorry. I thought you said two different things. Does 70% go to the general fund or 70% to the environmental fund?
70% goes to the environmental fund. 30% goes to the general fund.
Thank you.
And Mr. Horn. Chair, I think, you know, we made a little bit of a run at this last year and unsuccessfully, but I hope that, you know, this good discussion we're having about money being raised going to its intended purpose, that we're able to sort of look at that 30% and make sure we can keep it here. I mean, who knows where it goes at that point? So, you know, we're collecting it for an environmental purpose. It should go for an environmental purpose. We're collecting it for a solid waste purpose. It should go for a solid waste purpose. So I just wanted to make sure that's an item of discussion for
us. Good point, Representative Hornstein. Members, I encourage you to keep this information. It'll be back here tomorrow. Thank you, MPCA, and we'll see you tomorrow morning.